Welcome, everyone, to the teleseminar, Confused About Love. Maybe you are confused a little bit. Maybe you're confused a lot. We're going to be talking about ways of becoming unconfused, getting clear about love, that wonderful, mysterious force that we all want, we all participate in, and we all get confused by from time to time. This is Lyon Goodman, and I welcome you, and I'm here with Karista.
Hello.
Karista, there we are. And we're going to be giving you a lot of information about what we've discovered over the past years about how love works down deep in the brain and our neural connections and our connections with each other, and talk about how the neurology supports the psychology of early attachment and adult relationships. That's the big topic for today. And I'm very, very pleased that you've all joined us. We had over 250 people sign up for this class, and we're very excited to present it to you because this is really breakthrough research. We've looked at love from both sides now, from many different sides, and we feel like the breakthroughs that we've discovered are really useful, and we're going to make this very practical for you. It's not just going to be theory. We're going to give you some actual practices to use in your own love life to make your own relationship more secure and more passionate. So I welcome you. I'm really glad you decided to spend this hour with us, and we're going to be speaking for about an hour, and we'll be asking, there'll be times for questions in the middle, and then we'll stay after the hour and answer more questions if you have them. And so we're on Maestro Conference. You are all probably familiar with Maestro, but you can mute yourself with the number 6 on your keypad, and you can unmute with 6. We also have control over the mute button. So if you have a question, press 1 on your keypad. We'll see your hand raised, and then we will call on you as we can. There will be times to when we'll ask for a vote or a poll. For example, right now, if you feel like you are confused about love from 0, none at all, to about 25% of the time, press 1 on your keypad. And if you are confused about love from 25 to 60% of the time, press 2. And if you are confused about love more than 60% of the time, press 3. And that'll just give us a poll about you and who our listeners are. And so looks like we've got a pretty even group. There's about the same number of people in all three categories. So whether you're 1, 2, or 3, we're really glad you're here. We've got plenty to talk to you about. So in our work with couples and with singles, we find that about 90% of the people are confused about love, at least some of the time. And my background, I'll tell you a bit about my background, then Krista will tell you about hers, and then we'll dive into the program. My background is really focused on beliefs. Many of you know me from the Belief Closet process and Transform Your Beliefs. I also have taught classes in manifestation. I'm also a coach and an author. And in the love department, I've tried many different things with many different people. I've had great relationships. And I've also been confused a lot of the time. And it wasn't until my relationship developed with Karista, first as a working relationship and then as a love relationship, that I realized what it was I'd been missing all those other years. So it was a perfect match. Our backgrounds matched. Our understandings matched. We filled in information with each other, and we began teaching together, and we're on this wonderful learning and teaching journey as coaches and therapists, combining our learnings from many different disciplines. So we're very happy to be here with you. And Karista, why don't you give a little introduction to yourself?
Sure. My first professional passion began as a budding psych major, freshly graduated from Ivy League school, and began an early practice working with people under the guidance of a great therapist. And within a year or two, I started to realize that I was constantly surprised to see that adults were spending their adult years healing themselves from childhood trauma and abuse. And I thought, this is such an inefficient way of actually using your adult resources and time. And there must be some way to inspire, educate prospective parents how to prepare for parenthood so they could optimize the whole health of the child from the beginning of life. And there began quite a journey through a doctoral dissertation, a book, and the Parenting Center, as well as my own journey of mothering to really understand what these universal variables are that a young child needs from the moment of conception onward to really optimize its full potential. And I have come to realize that in my own humility as a wounded healer, having had to live the lightest and the darkest sides of love and relationships and counseling many, many through over 30 plus years, it was the discovery of the latest synthesis of almost 20 years of neuroscience and 2,000 studies that showed a correlation between early childhood attachment styles during the first 2 years of life, which was my earliest work, and its connection to adult intimacy dynamics. And it was the missing piece that really cracked the code for me with all that I knew conceptually about relationship from all the wonderful paradigms I had learned, that it was this missing piece about what happened in the bond between our primary love objects and how we were playing that out in our primary relationships. And I'm excited to share what I've learned and what we've learned and co-created together.
Yay. Yay. So here's what we're going to cover today in good form. Obviously, there's a lot to teach, and we only have an hour, so this is really a taste. It's an introduction to the topic. The first thing we'll talk about are the early attachment styles, how we bonded to our parent or didn't in infancy. And then we'll talk about how those childhood attachment styles affect our adult relationships. They may affect all of them or some of them, but they'll certainly affect those that are most intimate. Then we'll talk about the sabotaging mechanisms of each style, because each style can sabotage a relationship, where we go wrong. And then we'll talk about the neurosciences at the core, you know, why we do what we do from a brain perspective. And then we'll talk about the three nonverbal love languages and how they can be used to interrupt those cycles of reaction and repair the breaks in relationship. That's a very practical tool you can use. And we'll give you a specific practice and how to use it in your relationship. And obviously we can't fit all that into 1 hour, so we'll also be telling you about our upcoming teleseminar, which is a 5-week program with Entheos Academy, which we're very excited about. And then we'll have a Q&A afterwards and opportunities to ask questions as well in the middle of the presentation, as I mentioned. So, so let's dive in, shall we?
Mm-hmm.
Ready for that? All right, so Carista, talk about the 5 attachment styles, and we'll dive right into the subject.
Okay. So the 20 years of plus of neuroscience that have really joined with these 2,000 studies on attachment primarily discuss 3 attachment styles. Some discuss a 4th one, and we've added a 5th one. So I'm going to go with kind of the classic first 3 attachment styles. And that is basically saying that you are either securely attached to someone or you're insecurely attached. And the secure attachment is really its own style. And insecure attachment has 2 major styles called avoidant or anxious, which we'll talk about up ahead. And when you're in secure attachment, that's what's considered what I call healthy love and dependable love. When you're insecurely attached, that's what is considered less healthy love or can even be called dysfunctional love. And this distinction, yeah?
Oh, I was just going to say, by the way, for those of you who are listening, as Carista describes the different styles, think about the relationships you have with your partner or with your former partners, and also with your parents, your kids, your boss, anyone who you've got a very close relationship with, and just feel into the differences between those between those relationships with regard to each style. Go ahead, Carista.
Yeah. You can even look at, if you had a surrogate parent, a step-parent, or an adoptive parent, you would even have more to look at than your biological parents. So the secure attachment style is first going to be described between what a mother optimally is to give her child. And in the most idealistic setting, we would want the father to be this as well. But the child really needs this primary secure attachment from the mother to optimize its self-worth and its sense of trust the first 2 years of life. And what secure attachment looks like between a mother and child is that 80% of the time or better, the majority of the time, when the child puts out a sign of need, of distress, be it just a general need for food or attention, or it's really in trouble, the secure attached mother and or father will make that cry, that call for distress, a top priority. And the child's need becomes the most important thing because the child is completely dependent on the parent. What's called co-regulation. They need the parent. They're in relationship to get their needs met. They can't self-regulate alone. And to the degree that the child can put out this call for attention, be it a mild, moderate, or really important need, and the parent says, I hear you, I care about you, I care about your needs, you can trust me to be there for you, this creates healthy bonding. This is what love actually is from the child's point of view. And how the parent does that is very important. We'll talk about that up ahead, the three nonverbal love languages.
Good. And what if you're in an adult relationship, the secure attachment feels like this. It feels like you can really depend on the other person. It feels like they are committed to making you a priority, and you're committed to making them a priority. And when you're under stress or anxiety, you can count on them to come help you out and come help you into a more comfortable place. It's the sense that I matter to you and your needs matter to me. I may not be able to meet them immediately, but they matter. You feel cared about. And you feel like you can depend on the other person. And again, it's not 100% of the time. None of us can be available 100% of the time, just as parents can't be. But the vast majority of time, 80% of the time or better, I can count on you to be there when I need you. I can count on you to make me feel safe and secure.
Yeah, I can really trust you. I know that I'm important to you. That's wonderful. Now, the secure attachment styles, the two basic styles, are called anxious attachment and avoidant attachment. Both styles, an insecure attachment, want connection, but they have no clue how to get those needs met. And they usually create what many of us experience as these vicious cycles of reaction. An anxious attachment looks like between a mother and a child. The child puts out their need to the parent, and the mother will be there sometimes and not other times. And the child never knows when she'll be there and when she won't. The same with the father, if he's the primary love source. So the child puts out a sign of distress, I need you. And sometimes the mother will come running and be there, and other times. And the child is always in a state of low-grade anxiety, because even when the mother's there, the primary love source is there, the next time she may not be there. The avoidant style is when the child puts out a need for attention and there's no response. There may be the attention to, I'll change your diaper, I'll feed you your food. Emotionally, when the child's in distress, the middle of the night it wakes up or it's crawling around and it feels in danger or needs something that it can't articulate because it hasn't spoken yet, there will be no response most of the time. The parent is unavailable, what I call unavailable love, whereas the anxious is more unpredictable love. And most couples who are in reactive cycles they can't get out of are usually playing out one of these two primary insecure attachment styles. The anxious is often called a pursuer in an adult relationship. The avoidant is often called the avoidant. And they get in these escalated dynamics, not knowing how to crack the cycle. The good news is this is all very healable once you see what your style is. There are remedies very quick ones to stop the vicious cycles and rewire each other into secure attachment. It's really quite exciting.
And if you're in a relationship with an avoidant type, you know what that feels like. It means when you need them, they go away. Or if they have a need, they go off and take care of it themselves. They don't really feel needy. They don't want to feel needy. That's usually a terrible feeling for an avoidant type. So they are self-sufficient. They go off and they're in their own cave, if it's a man, or off with someone else, if it's a woman, usually. And so avoidant types, when you're in a relationship with an avoidant type, you may need them and they disappear. They may disappear physically, emotionally, mentally, or spiritually, but they're suddenly gone. And if you're in a relationship with a anxious pursuer type, you may feel that the person is needy a lot of the time. They come at you. They're always looking at you. They check to see if you're there or who you've been calling on your phone or in your emails. They're concerned. They're checking to see, do you really love me? They're insecure, and they're looking to get you to make them secure. And they can often escalate the pursuing just to get a response from you. Now, obviously, when a pursuer type and an avoidant type are in a relationship together, you get the dance of chasing each other back and forth. And each two types, when they get together, it's a different kind of relationship. So two secures look different than two avoidants. Two avoidants can have a great relationship. It's like ships passing in the night. Two anxious types can escalate all the time. Go ahead, Kristen.
Yeah. Well, two avoidants, I just want to embellish. You said they can have a great relationship, but they can have a very low reactive relationship because they're both avoiding conflict, but there's no real intimacy there. And the thing that is really compelling is to realize that the avoidants have as deep a need as the ones who are anxious to connect. They just don't know how because of their wounding. And if you take our 5-week teleseminar course, you'll hear a lot about how to heal those two styles, because my particular vulnerability in my patterning was anxious and Lyons was avoidant. And we've really rewired each other in a way that we weren't able to do in our other relationships. And we'll share a lot of those wonderful, exciting, hot tips with you and be very vulnerable about what we went through in order to rewire. So we have a fourth style, which is called traumatic attachment. Traumatic attachment looks like when a child has one or both parents that when they put out their needs, the response is very scary. It can be emotionally or physically or mentally abusive. And when one has traumatic attachment, it is a nuance of insecure attachment. You usually have it on top of either an avoidant style parent or an anxious style parent who happens to also be really scary and traumatic how they do or don't respond to your needs as an infant. And this creates a disordered nervous system. We'll talk a bit about the brain and the neurology up ahead. So how do you know if you or your partner are playing out traumatic attachment as kind of an extra complex of patterns to navigate through is when the reactions to what you do or what they do is disproportionate. The reaction is disproportionate to what actually is happening. And you can't really feel the correspondence in real time. Often, if that's a reoccurring experience, there's traumatic attachment disorder that's playing out in the primary relationship of the adult dynamic. Remember that when we're in the adult relationship of intimacy, once we get into the sexual dance, the primary love needs and the wounding, the places we weren't held as in a way that felt safe and secure, we're most likely going to project with that primary love object like we did in childhood, where we may not be playing out the same dynamic in our friendly relationships that don't have the sexual component in it. And traumatic attachment in particular really plays out once the bonding of sexuality is really starting to be unleashed.
And then some people have a hybrid of these. Would you talk about that?
Yeah, it's what we've come to call a hybrid, where people are a mixture. So you have a most people have a predominant style, or they can be a combination based on what they experience with each parent or some primary love source that was a surrogate parent early in life. Usually the first 2 years define the dominant style, and we'll explain why that is up ahead. And you can go back and forth. You might choose a partner where you're playing out your mother wound, where the mother was avoidant, and then choose a partner or certain dynamics in a partnership where you had a secure parent, and that particular person represents those dynamics. And so you can, over the period of life, go in and out of choosing partners to reconcile, you know, some of your own patterning. If you were a hybrid in childhood, and you might even have secure attachment in childhood, and unbeknownst to you, just because life happens and we're not only a product of our childhood, you might draw in someone you love, you have great connection with, who was traumatized, and because you had secure attachment in childhood, you have no idea how to really hold that person through their trauma healing.
Great, and that brings us to the fifth style. This is the one that we've identified that is, we call the healing attachment style, Krista.
So the healing attachment style is when you use the partnership to heal each other, to really learn how to experience and express and embody love, the direct experience of love. And what requires to be in a healing attachment, whether it's a short-term relationship, it's not your what you consider to be your lifelong partner, or it is your partner in the long term, it's the mutual desire to use the relationship to learn how to master being in secure attachment and be loving. So you, one or both of you may not even understand what secure attachment is, but the commitment to learn what it is and to really strengthen your capacity to learn how to be there as and make the other partner top priority, particularly when they're under duress or distress. And all of the variables will define what secure attachment looks and feels like in adult relationship becomes a joint mutual interest and commitment.
Right, and whether you call this a conscious relationship or a spiritual relationship or an enlightened relationship, it is a healing process. It is recognizing that we all have wounds and that we can heal them. And it's in this case, it's making a solid commitment to each other to rewire your mutual brains so that you can improve the relationship step by step, heal the wounds that you have internally, and rewire for secure relationship with each other.
Yeah, and I have some clients and friends who know they're with partners or want to make a commitment for a period of time with partners where they together decide that they want to use their time together to really heal each other. And yet there is a certain limit in one's capacity to feel the best of secure attachment when you know there might be an end in sight, because underlying that short-term commitment is the possibility that one might reject or abandon the other. And that's really the core dynamic that creates insecurity in all styles, is the fear of being abandoned, physically or emotionally, or rejected. And so it becomes very important in a healing attachment relationship that there's an agreement that there's a freedom to share your vulnerability of feeling rejected or abandoned, so that that actually ends up being part of the safety and security that I can report that, and you're going to care about it, and we're going to, you know, co-regulate each other with agreements that are safe for both of us. There's a mutuality. It's a mutual commitment to make it safe for both, whereas codependency is when you're in a relationship where only one is making that commitment to make it safe.
Mm-hmm. Great. So let's take a look inside yourself. Think about your own attachment style that you've probably heard it in our description. You might be a hybrid, but think about your predominant style. Are you predominantly securely attached? Are you predominantly anxious or avoidant or traumatized, or are you in a committed healing relationship? So we'd like you to vote for yourself. One, if you are secure. Two, if you are anxious. Three, avoidant. Press 4 if you are traumatized, 5 if you're in a healing relationship. So press 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5 on your phone, and I'll go over them again. 1 is a securely attached person, 2 is the anxious type, the pursuer, 3 the avoidant, 4 the traumatized, and 5 in a committed healing relationship. So this will just give us a sense of where you are as an audience. We have just a couple of secure people. Good for you.
Lucky you.
It is the minority, about 4% of the folks on the call. There's a pretty even spread between the anxious and avoidant types, about 20% each. And we've got about 13% of the people have identified themselves as traumatic, and that's really great to be self-aware enough to know that. And we've got about the same number of people, 13%, who are in a secure healing relationship. So that's great. So it's a nice bell curve with only a couple of lucky people who are securely paid. It's like that small convention called Adult Children of Normal Parents. It's a very small convention.
Right.
Yeah.
The great news is for those who don't have secure love yet, you can learn how to do it very quickly.
Mm-hmm. Great. Okay, good. So that concludes the five style conversation. And now we're going to talk about the sabotaging mechanisms, because each style can sabotage a relationship, even the secure style. People would ask, well, how could a secure person sabotage? And secure people might take the relationship for granted, for example. They're so secure that they kind of forget that a relationship is something they have to work on. Obviously, an anxious style who is pursuing the other person and escalates the need to be connected can cause an avoidant person, for example, to be overwhelmed and they disappear. Now that, of course, traumatizes the anxious person further, because they've been abandoned, so that escalates the problem even further, which then may cause the pursuer to pursue even more. So you get all the way up to the extremes of that, and you have the stalking relationship. So Chris, would you like to give some more examples of the sabotaging mechanisms?
Yeah, well, you mentioned the secure attachment style. We go into depth around each of these in the 5-week with the avoidant. Their tendency is to want space. That's what avoidant means, and to avoid the connection. What that will do is that will leave them feeling continually disconnected and alone, with no chance of intimacy to get their needs and feelings for love ever valued. So they're basically choosing to isolate themselves from experiencing true loving relationships and getting their own needs met.
Another one? Do you have another example?
Well, the trauma attachment is very tender, and I have a lot of compassion for those who have had traumatic attachment. I have, and have healed myself from it for the most part. And that one is very difficult, because if you don't heal that, then the high reactions that really create often a kind of a trance response and a disassociated response to what's really happening will end up creating a lot of unnecessary drama, particularly for the other partner. And so the importance of healing trauma attachment is that you actually get to learn that you can ask for what you need to feel safe and secure, and to trust someone, and to learn how to have a voice to do that, but to make sure you find someone that actually wants to help you rewire your traumatic responses. But if you don't, then your tendency is more apt to kind of feel danger as a threat and project that you don't trust love or trust a person in your primary relationships.
Great. Let's just take a pause for a moment and see if there's any questions about these 5 styles and their sabotaging mechanisms. If you have a question, press 1, and we'll take a few questions and then move on to the neurosciences. So if you have a question or a comment, please press 1 on your phone. And let's start with Stephen. Stephen, go ahead.
We're asking people to really keep this on the essence level for this particular call.
Okay, my thing is I am anxious, but I think I'm justified because I have met this very nice young lady and she seems to like me, but I am telling her, hi dear, I think you're very nice, but I'm way too old for you and there is a 50-year difference. So am I not justified in being a bit anxious about getting into a situation like that?
Sure. The anxious type being one myself needs to realize that the anxiety actually does carry a lot of wisdom. And many anxious types override that instinct of anxiety, trying to tell them something's not safe and secure for you. So anxious means that you report to yourself and to the one that you're trying to create a healthy relationship with, that you have these concerns that make you anxious. And then together you decide whether you can create healthy, safe conditions for that anxiety based on your mutual needs or not. So yes, the anxiety is indicative that some need in you or some concern actually needs to be addressed and cared for.
And it's clear that a 50-year difference in any two people is going to put them into a different kind of relationship than people near the same age. So it'll, you know, the generational difference alone is dangerous for any kind of continued relationship. So the wisdom that's coming through is, yes, this is a very tricky situation. So good luck with that.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. All right, let's go to Alana. Alana, you're on.
I'm wondering if I am avoidant only after getting into a relationship, but then I'm anxious before I get in the world. And then when somebody's interested in me, I become avoidant.
Yeah. Well, it could be you're playing out, you're one of these hybrids that's playing out two parts of your bonding style. You're being anxious is usually indicating that somebody doesn't feel safe and the fear of being abandoned or rejected. And then I would want to invite you to inquire the kind of person you're choosing to dance with in intimacy. You know, what is it about them or what is it about you that is really making you afraid to connect? You may be choosing the wrong kind of person that, you know, you don't feel safe with, or you might need to set up certain conditions with them up front in order to stay open to go deeper, and you're avoiding setting up the safe conditions, and therefore you don't really want to take the chance to trust them. There are many variables there to explore.
And, yes. There's also the experience of wanting someone because you feel lonely and you feel the desire for relationship. And then once you get it, you find that it's not what you expected or it's not all it's cracked up to be, or you're really not sure at that point because it brings up other issues for you. So that kind of, it's quite a common pattern, actually. And we'll be talking about that in our class.
Anxious have a real need for connection. They're preoccupied with the connection. But often, particularly if they have traumatic experiences, be it a lot of rejection or abandonment, or they've been really hurt by their parents or others, they're afraid to really put out what they need in order to feel safe for that connection. And they're expecting the other, particularly if they choose an avoidant, to know what they need in order to feel safe. And an avoidant has no clue because they're not preoccupied with connection. They're preoccupied with protecting themselves from connection because they're afraid of it. They've never had their needs and feelings valued. And they have just as strong a need for connection. They just don't know it. So they need to feel safe as well. And when someone's constantly anxious with them, they're more apt to run away.
Great. Okay, well, thanks, Alana, for that question. So we don't have time for more questions now, but we certainly will at the end of the hour. So
we'd love
your hands. Please stay on. Great. All right, well, now we're going to talk about some of the neuroscience at the core of this issue. I began studying neuroscience back in college in the early 70s, and the brain was simpler then. It's gotten very complicated. The more they do research, the more they find out, and it seems to be the most complex thing in the universe, the human brain. But even back then in the 70s, a man named Paul McLean had identified three major anatomical areas of the brain, and he called it the triune brain theory. The three parts are the brain stem. This is the reptilian part of the brain. Even reptiles have that much brain. And it contains the autonomic functions. It's the deepest primal part of us. Our involuntary reactions, our instincts, you know, get food, get comfort, avoid pain. And in a traumatic event, like when an antelope is being hunted, it's responding by running, but once it gets attacked and once it gets grabbed, it goes into what's called the freeze or fold reaction, which is definitely an old brain reaction, which is, okay, I'm done, I'm going to now be eaten. So that's the old brain stem. The second part of the anatomy is the midbrain or limbic center, and you've probably heard a lot about it, but this is the mammalian brain. Mammals have both the old brain stem and then the mammalian brain on top of that. This contains our troop and group instincts. That's the emotional brain. It has to do with bonding and status and group behaviors. And in danger, its reaction is primarily fight or flight. When we're in reaction, it's looking out for anything dangerous, and then once you're in danger, it sets off the alarm, and we either run or get ready to fight. So this is the classic fight or flight reaction, and then we add the older freeze and fold reaction as the four primary instincts. And of course, if you are an avoidant type, it's mostly the flight reaction that you do. And if you're an anxious type, it's mostly the fight or fight for what you need kind of reaction. And if you're traumatized, you may get a real mixture of those.
If you're traumatized, you're going to go into freeze and fold. And you actually go into the involuntary primal part of the brain on top of anything else, and your ability to fight or flight actually gets diminished.
And then obviously as humans, we grew this thing called the frontal lobes or the neocortex. And this is the area for thinking, for planning, for being creative, for connecting to the divine, projecting into the future and imagining. And the frontal lobes are where we can think rationally. The interesting part of this is that when your limbic system goes off as an alarm, the frontal lobes basically shut down. They don't shut down completely, of course, but what they do is that they send all the energy to the limbic system and the body for the fight-or-flight reaction. So when you're in a fight-or-flight reaction, when there's an alarm going off, it doesn't really matter what someone says to you. So the part of the limbic system that is the watchdog, we'll call it, is the amygdala. There are two of these parts of the brain, one on each side, and they are like sniffers. They're always looking to see where danger is coming from. And if they think there might be danger, they set off the smoke alarm, which is, watch out, there might be danger. And then if it looks like real danger, then the fire alarm goes off, and that's when you go into the reaction. So you can think of security as a spectrum from being very, very safe and secure, and then into slight insecurity, mild or moderate insecurity, where you're kind of looking around, not sure whether it's safe or not, into sort of major danger, which is there's definitely danger here, and then all the way into the extreme, which is panic or fight or flight reaction, where we can't think at all. So let's take a moment and just feel the differences in each of these responses, because we've all experienced all of them. And then the question is, where do you spend most of your time when you're in relationship? So let's start with the most secure. So think of someone in your life who made you feel most secure. It might have been one of your parents holding you. It might have been a grandparent, or a dear friend, the person you had the best relationship with, where you could really just let go and relax. So think of that person and feel held by them. Notice your breath might have slowed down. and feel your heartbeat. And feel the state of your nervous system. Resting, a bit anxious. What do you want to do? What is the motivation here? Is it just to lie back and relax? So that's the feel of a secure relationship in your nervous system and in your brain. And now think about someone else who you've been close to who makes you a little nervous in your relationship with them. You're just not sure what they're going to do. Are they going to be there for you, or are they not going to be there for you? Are they the sort of person that you can't count on, or just don't know about them? You don't know if they like you. Seem to, but there's something going on there. You just can't settle. So think of that person and feel, again, your breath, your heartbeat, the state of your nervous system. There's this uncertainty, this state of slight anxiety. Don't know what's going to happen. Now think about another person who you would like to rely on, but they're really unreliable. You just don't know what's going to happen from time to time. They might come home drunk one day and be a different person, or they might behave oddly from time to time, suddenly bursting into anger or break down. And feel what it feels like to be with that person. State of high anxiety where you really don't know what's going to happen next. And just feel how you feel being with that person. Do you want to run away from them? Do you want to take care of them? Want to help them or fix them in some way? Just notice what your tendency is. What you want to do when you're with this person who makes you feel this high anxiety. We'll do one more. Now feel a person, remember a person in your life who just made you crazy. Just their behavior was erratic or random. They loved you 1 minute and they hated you the next. Or they were taking care of you 1 minute and they were gone the next. And just feel in your nervous system the panic that sets in. Maybe someone who came into your house and you didn't know whether they were going to hug you or slug you or yell. Just feel what happens to your nervous system when you're in that panic mode. Do you want to run and hide? Do you want to run up to them and grab them and control them, manipulate them, become invisible, or rescue them, or something else? There's something that you want to do when you're in that state, when the person's unpredictable. Notice your breath, feel your heartbeat. Feel the sense of panic that can set in when you're with that person. Let all that go. Take a moment and feel yourself completely. And now, you've spent your time in many different relationships. Think about where your nervous system has been in most of your relationships. Not all, because you've experienced the full spectrum, but if you have felt secure most of the time, press 1 on your phone. And if you have felt slightly anxious most of the time, more than 50% of the time, press 2. If you've felt very anxious in your relationships, press 3. And if you've felt panicky in most of your relationships, press 4. And obviously, we're smart people. We wouldn't be on the call otherwise, so you wouldn't spend a lot of time around someone who makes you crazy. But who knows? Like, I've been in relationships that made me crazy, so sometimes there's good reasons to stay in them. We're looking for like most of your relationships. Good. Well, fortunately, there's only a couple people who have who've pressed 4, so you have our empathy and our sympathy. We've got a pretty even group between the 2s and 3s and a smaller number in 1. So it's a bell curve with the 2s and 3s in the middle. So thank you. So that's just a visceral experience of the 4 limbic states. So now we're going to switch over and talk about how do you quiet those upsets. How would it be possible to take someone who's in one of those anxious states and get them settled down, get them back to a 1, to a secure feeling and a sense of security and love? If you're in a partnership, you need to have the skills to bring your partner into that secure state, to re-secure them, and they need the ability to bring you into that state so that you can get out of the panicky modes and back into a secure love. So, Carista, take it from here.
Oh, beautiful. Well, I went through those 4, and I could just feel the distinctions between what happens with my breath and heart and nervous system from the safe to the dangerous. It's night and day. And that inspiration is to really give us a sense of what happens when the fire alarm, the limbic center, goes into a state of nervousness or anxiety that we're not safe. Can we pattern interrupt that and turn it off? So that is often the cause of what keeps couples in those vicious cycles at night when they're processing and upset and reacting. One or both fire alarms are off, feeling insecure, unsafe, and they don't know how to do that. And so that's what we're going to offer you now, just an understanding of the beginning of that practice of pattern interrupt, and we'll elaborate further in the 5-week teleseminar as we keep referring to that. So we call this section of mastery the 3 nonverbal love languages. And as Lyne suggested, they're very practical ways how to comfort the limbic system when it's in distress. And so what one wants to consider is, again, back to those first few years of bonding. Bonding and attachment are synonymous. And when a child, when you in particular, were forming your brain, and particularly the 6 months to 2 years of age, before you can even speak, is when most of the wiring occurs, which is why the nonverbal ability to be able to quell each other and rewire each other becomes a very powerful portal of practice. So if you can imagine when you are a child, you know, it's starting to go out into the world at 6 months. That's when they start to separate from the mother and go into what's called self-regulation, from being totally dependent on another source to co-regulate them. And they're crawling away from the mother, and they see something on the rug, and they don't know if it's a snake or a rope. And the child puts out a sign of distress and anguish because it feels unsafe, doesn't know what it is. And in the secure attachment model, the mother would come, or whoever was there, and pick up the child. And because the child doesn't understand words, she can't say you're safe, and the child begin to, you know, turn off its fire alarm of danger. She needs to use the 3 languages of love, which are touch, the way she picks up the child. If her nervous system is quiet and relaxed and safe, the child will feel it immediately as she brings the child close to her body, or the father, or some primary love source. The second love language is the tone of the voice, not even the words. If the voice is, you're okay, I'm here, you're safe, And that is in the tone of the voice. She could even say, you're not okay, you're not safe, and the child would feel and hear the voice because it doesn't know the words yet. So the tone of the voice is the second love language. And the third is the use of the eyes, the way the primary love source actually looks at the frightened child. So if the mother looks at the child and the child can look in the mother's eyes and her eyes look safe and relaxing and reassuring, the child's nervous system and limbic center is going to say, I'm safe. I'm in the safety zone. She's got me. Her body's relaxing me. Her voice is soothing me. Her eyes are just so loving. And that is secure attachment at its best. An example of an insecure experience for a child, and this plays out with our lovers, is if the child, it is a snake, it is something scary, and the primary love source, be it the mother when we're children or our lovers, actually are indifferent. And that indifference is often communicated not just in words of indifference, but the nonverbal body language. So the parent or the partner actually gets rigid and scary or disinterested or defended, and it's not safe, and our nervous system can't be quelled by their touch, and their voice is agitated or aggravated with us. You know, you're okay, you know, you're fine, don't worry about it, and the child or the adult is frightened in some way, reason or not, snake or rope could be real, and the love source doesn't really reassure them with their tone of voice. Their words might say something, but their tone of voice is aggravated and scary, irritated, unsafe. And the eyes don't reflect love. They reflect indifference, anger, agitation. Even if the mother or the partner says, I hear you, I care about your feelings, and all the words are there, but their voice is upset, their eyes look scary or angry, and their body language could really care less.
Yeah. So how do we use these love languages in our relationships? Because that's the key here, is that when your partner or your child or your boss or anyone, when your intimate relationship is getting anxious and upset, either in avoidant style or in anxious style, how do you get them settled down?
Yeah, well, the touch, the way you touch or move, needs to intentionally reflect love. And the tone of the voice needs to deliberately reflect a quality of love, or at least neutrality that's not more agitating and puts the other person in a defensive reaction. And the eyes, the way one looks, need to reflect a loving and or caring attention to that person.
So everyone has their own particular preference. Each person has their own preference for one of those three love languages, and often a combination of the two. So I, for example, love to be touched and looked at eye to eye. That really works for me. Soothing voice is great, but if I have a choice, just touch me and look in my eyes and tell me it's okay. Carista, what's your favorite?
Touch, voice, and eyes. Well, often when you and I are in, you know, our dance and something's been triggered, if we're together, not over the phone, then when you just touch me, say, let's just go, you know, we start to get at it, and you say, let's just go lie in the bed and just hold each other before we talk about it. Or if we can't do that, and you or I, and you in particular, you know, might have a tone of voice, I had a rageaholic father, and you don't even know it, but I might just say, you know, please could you talk in a softer voice? I can hear what you're feeling because I'm starting to trance out. So for me, it's touch and voice, and I love it when eyes are looking lovingly at me as well, because I had a scary parent who looked very scary a lot.
So in your relationship, this is the magic key that we wanted to give you tonight. When your partner is in upset, if you talk to them, I guarantee they will not be hearing you. The cortex is shut down, basically. When the limbic system goes into fire alarm, they are not thinking. They cannot hear your words. And you can continue to talk to them and tell them rationally what's wrong with them or what they could do to fix it, but they will not be able to hear you. So if you are slightly more conscious than the other person, then what you do is you switch into one of these nonverbal modes, and you grab them unless they have a reaction to touch, and then you talk to them sweetly, you hold them close, pull them close, and get them to get their limbic system settled down so that they can then hear what you have to say. But it takes a few minutes to do that. And this is a magical formula. I've been a guy who rationally tells my woman, what's wrong with her and how to fix it. And when I'm sitting over here looking at her sternly and talking sternly and telling her what's wrong with her, she is not going to be able to hear me no matter what I say. As brilliant as I am or as creative my solutions, there is no listening. So once I learned this trick, once I learned this technique of speaking to the limbic system, not to the brain, things turned around for me, and I was able to move into a much more loving place and get out of the reactive mode that I'd been in and that she had been in. You want
yes.
to add to that, Krista?
Yes, and I, in the class, we'll go into detail about how to learn your own and your partner's, if you're in a relationship, best love language, or if you're single and you're looking for someone, you'll be able to know what to look for. And then how to use those love languages to create more connection and security. So we look forward to sharing that with you for those who want to go further.
Indeed. So we only have a couple minutes left, so I'm going to sort of quickly talk about our upcoming program. We're so appreciative of your spending this hour with us. And if you can hang out and listen to people's questions and have questions of your own, please do. We'll stay on for up to a half an hour if there's that many questions. But let me tell you very quickly about our program. We were invited by Entheos Academy to produce this program with them. And you can go to confusedaboutlove.com and find out all about it. It's a 5-week program in which we go into much more depth about each of these topics. We work with you individually, and there's a lot of Q&A time to get your questions answered. We give specific practices for taking into your relationship and making it better. If you're a single, it helps to learn what to look for in a partner and what to avoid if you're out hunting for your partnership. And we work as very deep transformational healers and teachers with each person in the course. It's 5 Tuesdays starting October 2nd, and it's all in October, the 2nd, 9th, 16th, 23rd, and 30th. So it's the 5 Tuesdays of October, this time 5 p.m. Pacific, for 60 minutes each time, plus an additional 30 minutes of open forum after each class so that you can get your questions answered. And it's only $125, very inexpensive for the value you get. You're going to get a tremendous amount of information that you can take right into your relationship. You'll get practices to take into your relationship, not only with your partner, but with other people. You'll come out of there really understanding much more about this powerful mechanism that runs us and drives us in our relationships. So, again, you can go to confusedaboutlove.com and sign up there. And we'll be happy to have you join us and pass on more of these hot tips for developing a secure and passionate relationship. And I want to just add that the passionate part is really important. When this is especially true for women, for those men out there, when a woman feels secure, when she can trust the man, she can open more fully. And when she trusts 100%, she can open 100%. And this is what men are looking for. Men actually are looking for a woman who can open fully to them. And when she opens fully, he's satisfied. When he's satisfied, he wants to make the relationship more secure. He becomes more loyal. He becomes thrilled to be in relationship. And a lot of men withhold their commitment because they're looking for that 100% opening. And what they don't know is that women can't open until they have the commitment. So this is what causes a lot of non-committal relationships to go on and on and on. Man's kind of waiting around for the woman to open fully with her passion and with her love and with her heart and her beauty, and the woman's waiting around for the man to actually make a commitment so she can give that. So once you know that, then you can interrupt that pattern and create a secure relationship from the beginning. Krista, you want to add to that? Then we'll have to close.
Yeah, I'd say that's a generalization. Of course, there are exceptions, but women's sexuality, particularly as they go into their 40s on up, is very dependent on whether their heart is open and they feel they can share their vulnerable insecurities, which is really what creates secure attachment, is the freedom and safety to create your insecurities. And men have learned through working with men and having a wonderful one that's on the phone who's honest with me what he needs. In general, they really need to feel appreciated and honored, admired, and recognized for their contribution, and that their feelings can be really valued and cared for. They're as important, their feelings and needs are as important as ours. They like to be really stroked and admired and looked up to as a hero. And women can learn to do that. And we'll talk more about some of these generalizations as well. There certainly are exceptions which will be included.
Great. Well, we're going to, first of all, just to close, those of you who need to leave, please leave with our blessings, and we hope to see you in our program, confusedaboutlove.com. Those who wish to stay, we welcome you to stay and ask your questions. We will give you the best of our wisdom on whatever question you want to ask, whether it's about your personal relationship or family or whatever this topic might bring up for you. Yes. So, thank you, Krista, for joining me on this wonderful call and program and our work together. I appreciate you.
Yeah, I just feel how much more I want to share, and I look forward to being able to do that because there's so many gems here that can really save people a lot of suffering and really give them the tools to experience the best of love.
Yeah. That's it. That's what we want to do. We want to share the best of love with you so you can bring the best of love to your life. So, again, if you need to leave, thank you so much for staying with us for this hour, and we hope to see you down the road somewhere. And if you'd like to stay, we will be happy to answer your questions. So if you have a question, press 1 on your phone dial, and we'll take them one at a time and give you the best of what we have to offer. So press 1, and let's start with Elizabeth. Elizabeth, go ahead.
Oh, hi. Actually, I have a couple of questions, but my first one is that how can you tell a difference between whether you're an anxious, have the anxious style of attachment or the traumatized one?
Mm-hmm.
I get a little confused sometimes.
Sure. Well, there would have to be some diagnosis there, most thoroughly, particularly if there's trauma attachment, but trauma includes anxious. So if you've been traumatized, you're going to be anxious because you're afraid that you're going to be in danger at any given moment. The traumatic attachment, the additional patterning that occurs, is you look back to your roots in kind of your historic pattern in love relationships from childhood to adulthood, and look at whether you felt highly threatened in some of those experiences where you felt like you could never feel safe, you could never turn the fire alarm off, and the person was really threatening and felt dangerous. Because love does not feel dangerous. Love does not feel dangerous. It's a safe, secure feeling. It's like that mother who hears the child in distress and makes it a priority to make that child feel safe and harmonious. So those are some distinctions. Watch what's happening with your nervous system. If when you look to a love source, you're able to be calmed by them and calm yourself. And if not, no matter what they do, there's usually a traumatic attachment complex of patterns that you're actually disassociating into.
And if the person that you're in relationship with is actually unpredictable, then it may not be that you have a traumatic pattern, but you're in relationship with someone who has that trauma.
That was going to be my next question. So I'm not sure if it's me or him.
Yeah.
Really. And my personal past, there was a lot of abandonment, and I was stuck in a boarding school and sort of ostracized because I didn't speak the language, and it was abandoning experience and disconnection in a global sense, but wasn't really in a one-on-one relationship. It was more like with a relationship with everything. But
Krista, do you want to respond? Go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah, well, in general, boarding school experiences for kids is usually an experience of their parents avoiding them. In other words, their parents don't
right.
want to be in, making them a top priority in their life. That's not always the case, by the way. And there are plenty of people in boarding school who have great relationships with their parents. But, in, you know, if you feel that's a place to look first, like why
oh, yeah.
you know, is it?
I've done a lot of work on it already. So.
Sure. And just knowing we have other questions to get to, in essence, I'd say that the kind of partner we choose is usually mimicking something we're trying to work out, especially if there's constant reaction and drama and conflict that doesn't get resolved easily. Is the kind of partner we're choosing is a reflection of the insecure attachment wiring that we had earlier on. So, I had a rageaholic father. It was very traumatic to me. It wasn't as traumatic to another sibling, but it definitely qualified the kind of men I chose. Even if they presented very loving, very awake, there was a correspondence in there in some of those relationships where, you know, their own wounding and mine really had quite a heyday, even though on a conscious level we appeared to be loving, awake individuals.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's the shadow, the wounding, that starts to engage, that we often bypass until we're in that intimacy. So it's the kind of partners we choose. And that doesn't matter. You can choose a partner who's had trauma, who's had insecurity. I have, and I am, you know, Lyne and I have came to each other with insecurity. So the good news is that if you both commit to wanting to rewire each other and learn secure love, it doesn't really matter what your past is. If you find someone that wants to hold you through learning what you need to feel safe and secure.
Okay, thanks, Elizabeth. Appreciate the question. Let's go to Deborah. Deborah, you're on.
Hi. Let's see, how do I distill my question most? So I think I'm an avoidant. I have a really good relationship with my parents, but I'm in a relationship that's coming up in about a year where he is just so there for me and anything I can dish out, but his trigger for feeling abandoned is like super light. Like I'm going on a business trip tomorrow and it's totally triggered. And so from afar, I heard what you said when someone gets triggered about the things you can do, but I'm wondering if there's any recommendations on what you can do when you're, like, I'm off on a trip and he's triggered.
Yeah.
And almost anything I do will not work. It's, like, really hard to meet him when he's, what his need is in that place. So we're trying to figure that out. I would say he probably has the traumatic attachment you're talking about.
Yeah.
So is that clear? I don't know.
Yes, I'm clear on that. Lyne, you want me to
yes.
start with that? So first he has to, he doesn't have to, but what would benefit him, perhaps let him listen to this tape if he's open, is to really admit that what his attachment, insecure attachment style is, and for you to clarify what your attachment style is so that you know what you're working with, and that that really depersonalizes the reactions. It's like, oh, no wonder I'm avoidant, or oh, no wonder I'm secure, and I had parents, and you know, I never had this, and this is a foreign language to me that I've never been around trauma. I don't understand trauma, so now I see that's what you know why you're so hypersensitive, and I've been personalizing it. But actually, you know, we really need to be able to focus in on how to make you feel safe. So secure attachment people, when they connect with someone who's had trauma or insecure, they have to be very patient and want to use their wisdom and their love to help this person, you know, reestablish a direct experience of safety. So the key is to find, you know, give me three kind of daily rituals that would really, if you could get them from me, would help you feel your connection to me. So first he has to reveal where he feels insecure and disconnected in a way that feels safe. And that's your data to find out, okay, if that's the case, then let's look at some things we can do while I'm traveling-oriented, that will give you a sense of connection reassurance. He might say, I just need to hear from you in the morning when you wake up, but, you know, and just a text or an email letting me know you're on my mind. And I'd really love a call before you go to sleep, because I just feel my connection with you, and you can be really loving with him and reassure him that you miss him and you care about him and ask him about his day. And then he goes to sleep with you in his heart. I mean, it can be very, very simple daily rituals to help build that bridge that he can actually feel the connection he's craving. And you have to want to give it to him, even if you don't need it. That's part of the commitment for secure attachment and rewiring each other.
That's great. Is that good for you, Deborah?
Yeah, I only thing that comes up is in the past when I've called, he's so triggered that it hasn't, it's easier said than done to do what you're just saying.
Sure. I mean,
we'll start, Deborah, do start with having him listen to the tape. We'll be sending out the recording in just a day or two and so that he can begin to understand his own pattern. That's what's crucial here. And so
yeah.
I think that was really good advice.
He has to want to actually learn a new way of responding and not and realize he's in trauma, but want to give you security as well and care for how it's affecting you and want to respond to your efforts to try to care for him. If he's not digesting those or he doesn't care that you're needing him to actually de-escalate, then that becomes part of the healing challenge and part of the healing solution. And it may be, you know, you're saying all the right things, but your tone of voice is not touching him. You might just, you know, I don't know, but an example could be, honey, I'm here, whatever, whatever, but you sound like his, you know, irritated, disinterested mother. I'm not saying that's the case, but that's where the nonverbals. So, you know, you might want to just say, you know, what's the tone of voice? Give me some of the words. Don't make me guess so I can actually give you what you need. But, it, you know, it can be very complex projection going on, and that might take some individual care. So thank you for that.
Yeah, thanks, Deborah. Let's go to Alana. Alana, you're on the line. Alana, did you have a question?
Sorry, I had a phone thing. Yes, so I'm trying to rationalize the difference between, well, I come from an enmeshed background, so, like, trying to do things to make other people feel secure kind of
yep.
feels sort of off to me also. And then the other thing is also my spiritual orientation is that I'd want to turn to God to feel secure. So then also for me to turn to a person to make me feel secure also is tripping that up.
Sure. Beautiful. Thank you for that transparent sharing. So when one's had an enmeshed, meaning for some people who don't know what that means, one's purpose is to be a caretaker for the other at the expense of their own well-being, the invitation to actually consider love as something where you're interdependent with someone else and needing someone else becomes more threatening. And that is definitely, you know, very strong for those who are in codependent relationships where their purpose for being was in service to caring for the needs of the other, but the other didn't care about them. And that's not what we're promoting. We're promoting a mutual, secure attachment is when there's a mutual commitment to care for each other's needs equally. So that I'm wondering if you choose people that care for your needs where you can be taken care of as much as you've taken care of others. And the second reflection to your second point, and then opening to Lion's reflection, is you're talking about your relationship to God as a place to regulate yourself, what we often call self-regulation. Co-regulation is when you depend on someone outside of you to help bring you harmony and quell your distress, be it emotional or physical or mental. And self-regulation is where you don't depend on anyone and you're self-sourcing, self-soothing. We absolutely need the capacity to do both as adults because often, even in the most secure relationships, our adult partner can't be there. They've got a phone call, they've got a business trip, whatever. So this is a wonderful capacity to be able to self-regulate. The only challenge is when you don't have a choice to be able to get your needs met or cared for by another person. When you choose self-regulation in your relationship to God or inner source as your primary source of sustenance to feel connection. If you don't have the connection to either self-regulate or co-regulate, then we're offering you a greater experience of love, either with yourself, which is greater self-regulation, or co-regulation is love with another. Lion, anything you want to add?
Yes. Many people go to God for their primary relationship because human relationships are so messy. And relationship to God in the transcendent, not the personal, the impersonal transcendent, is actually a safe place. It's much safer than messy human relationships. So I can understand the desire to do that. We're talking primarily about the messy human relationships. I think everyone needs a relationship with God and spirit, whatever their personal connection is, because it's part of our life. It's part of spiritual life. But if you go there to get away from human relationships, then it may be a sort of an extreme kind of avoidance. And that's not to denigrate any spiritual path, but many spiritual paths take you away from family, away from people. This is the path of the monk, perfectly valid for some people. But I would just look deeply and to say, you know, do I also want to have a deeply spiritual relationship with a partner?
Everyone gets to choose their path for sure.
Thanks for those questions, Alana. And now let's go to Marina. Marina, you are on the line.
I joined a little bit later, and I wonder if my question may be a bit too complex. Yeah, just tell me if it is.
Okay.
The question is, I had two long-term relationships in my life that I broke off, and when I separated from these people, I felt that I was the one abandoned, I felt that I was dumped, and I completely distorted the relationship in my head. I felt it was my fault, if only I tried harder, you know, I had such a wonderful man and all that. You have any insights about that?
Ryan?
No, go right ahead.
I think what you're saying is that you thought you were in a good relationship and then you were unexpectedly rejected or abandoned?
No. I was in a long-term relationship that
yep.
I would leave.
Yeah.
It would be a conscious choice.
Yep.
I would leave a relationship based on pretty serious parameters. And then when I would separate from these people, I would feel that they abandoned me and they dumped me, and I would distort the relationship in my mind, and I would feel that I want them. I was the one leaving, you know?
I see. Okay. But yeah, well...
Especially if they and found another partner.
Yeah.
Yes.
So Marina, this is not unusual, and it's if you understand how the mind works, you may have had a lot of good reasons to leave. The fact that you're in a long-term relationship means that you can be in a relationship that long-term, but people do grow, and they often grow apart from each other, especially if one is growing and the other one isn't. So leaving a relationship, leaving a long-term relationship, it's certainly not a crime. It's part of life. But then what you did with it afterwards is a separate issue. You know, and we are great rationalizers in our minds. Our minds are able to convince us that certain things are true. So it's not unusual. You might be interested in the belief work that we do, because you have two sets of beliefs in there that are in contradiction. One is, I got to get out of here. The other is, I've been abandoned. And so your mind is just using the beliefs to make sense of what occurred. But I don't see anything particularly traumatic or dangerous in it to you, Kristen.
Oh, I spent years and years beating myself up and not dating and feeling miserable. If you ask me, you know, you divorced your husband, did you do the right thing? I would have to think, like, for 30 minutes what to answer.
Okay, yeah. So there's some work to be done there.
So you think it has to do more
yeah.
with beliefs than with attachment and abandonment issues?
Well, it's all mixed in there. I would say, I mean, those are two different portals. And there, we work with them together when we do private work with people. The distinguishing characteristic here is that you're mimicking what we call preoccupied anxious attachment and that unpredictable love. So I would point you to look at, you know, which of your parents role modeled what you are actually describing, which is you want the person, then you don't want the person, then you want the person again. And so, you know, where we always get to be free regarding what happens in our relationships when they don't work out is we get to look at what is this mirroring back to me about my relationship to love, trust, safety, and security, the kind of partner I choose, as well as the kind of partner I am. And you know, the most important place to go first, I've found as a healer of 35 years working with individuals and couples in these crises and pattern complexes, is to look back to the original relationship with each parent. So someone, you know, take each one of these men and listen to our tape again if you missed the beginning, important parts, and then write their name down and write down where, you know, you felt that they, what style you felt they were playing out, avoidant or anxious or secure or traumatic, and then what style you were playing out with them, and go through each relationship and then see if there's a pattern there. And you might find that you're playing out one parent or another, you're wounding with them or you're programming with them with one particular partner. Or you might be playing out the same thing over and over again, and then you'll be more keen the kind of partner you're choosing and the kind of attachment style you're embodying and playing out. And that will give you diagnostically a very clear sense of, you know, what the antidotes are, what the healing program is in order to change that, which is, you know, how you show up in relationship to offer safety and security or insecurity, and how the other shows up in relationship that you choose. So it's, you know, really looking at our own relationship to ourself and our behavior and the other's behavior is really where the diagnosis is, to crack the code of the vicious cycles of being an avoidant or being in some kind of insecure reaction as the dominant. I do want to just say for the tape and for those who may be listening to the end, that secure attachment is not an ideal perfect state. It's not like we have to always be there every time our partner, you know, puts out a signal of distress or needing us, and if we're not, we're therefore promoting insecurity. It's really when the vast majority of the time we are making the partner a priority. And if we can't, particularly if we're an avoidant, we care how we say no, and we let that partner know we're going to come back as soon as we can to care for their needs. And if we're anxious, if we really need connection, we're going to be really mindful how we ask for that connection, so that it really invites the person to want to care for us. We don't frighten them. We don't flood them. We're very aware, particularly if they're sensitive to being needed, to make it inviting for them to want to care for us. And this doesn't have to be all the time. And if the person is really in an extreme state of need, then what we want to do is we want to let them know we hear them, we care, we love them, and we're going to care for them as soon as we can, and remind them that they can find healthy ways to self-regulate and soothe themselves until we can be there to care for them. And that's really what secure attachment looks like. It's not a perfect state of I'm there, you know, on demand. I'm there upon your loving request for me, and that becomes a high priority for me, and you need to care for when I can't, why I can't. I am responsible to communicate that to you in a way that you feel that is love and know that I'll be there as soon as I can.
Beautiful. Thanks, Marina. And we have a question from David. Oops, one second. David, go ahead. David, you pressed a number on your phone. Do you have a question? It had been a mistaken press. All right. And we'll take one last question from Paula. Paula, go ahead.
Are you there, Lion?
That's me, and that's you.
Okay, let me change phones. Hang one second. What? Okay, I was losing my battery. I think my question is for Clarissa.
Mm-hmm, Clarissa.
Clarissa.
Yeah. Oh, I'm
okay.
Sorry, I said it wrong.
No problem.
I also had a raging alcoholic father, and so I put myself in the trauma category. I don't know how to put this into words. But I see where the anxiety, you said, I understood that it automatically comes with the trauma attachment is the anxiety. So is that considered a hybrid or not?
Yeah. Yeah, a traumatic is inherently a hybrid because it's either you had a parent who not only was scary, but they were either, you know, they were highly anxious or highly avoidant. I mean, you can have a rageaholic alcoholic father who didn't really, he didn't really, you know, project it towards you, but it was in the space all the time and made it scary, versus one that at any moment could hit you or come attack you in some way, psychically or physically, you know, that's a very anxious parent that is, you know, being very aggressive towards you. So, yeah, it's a hybrid, for sure. And it's healable. That's the good news. I can tell you firsthand as well as professionally. I mean, I didn't even share all the trauma that I've experienced this lifetime, but this is all able to be rewired. Ideally, if you can find a partner to be able to offer you and cares that you've been traumatized and offer you a feeling of safety, and if not, to find a healer that really understands traumatic insecure attachment and will provide that sense of safety for your primal inner parts to actually rewire with the healer. That becomes very important. But with a traumatic experience, you want to be very careful to realize that love is not a mixture with danger. And most traumatic people don't realize that. And one of the first steps is to diagnose that you have that vulnerability and then to make sure now as an adult, unlike a child where we couldn't choose our parents, you can now stop subjecting yourself to people who mimic that scary traumatic feeling. That's where this particular model can really empower someone to crack the code of being an insecure attachment. Even if you can't find someone, stop investing in people that dominate with a feeling of leaving you feeling insecure or traumatized. Was that helpful at all?
Oops, hold on. She doesn't have the microphone right now, but
okay.
The reason is that we need to complete.
Oh.
Paula, thank you for that question.
Thank you, Paula.
It is nearing 6:30, and we just want to so appreciate you for hanging in there and listening to us and sharing your experiences with us. Please go to confusedaboutlove.com if you want details about our program, which starts October 2nd. And feel free to contact us, Carista@AOL.com, that's C-A-R-I-S-T-A, or lion@beliefcloset.com, lion@beliefcloset.com. We're very happy that you joined us today. Really appreciate your time. Carista, thank you.
Thank you, Lion. It's a joy, and we're here for you. Anyone who needs support, blessings.
I'll just open the phone lines in case everyone would like to say goodbye. And 1 second here. There we go. The phone lines are open. So thanks, everybody.
Bye.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Great. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Great. Choose love. Choose love. Choose safety. Choose security.
Adios.
Peace.
Peace.